and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, California's wildfires continued to burn out of control over the weekend, with 77 people dead and at least 997 still missing. President Trump visited Paradise, California, the town that was completely devastated, and called it Pleasure, California. He also claimed that the president of Finland told him that raking the forest floor would prevent future fires. Next, Democrats in the Georgia and Florida governor's races and the Florida Senate race conceded to their Republican challengers over the weekend amid charges of voter suppression. Meanwhile, all seven of Orange County, California's House races went to Democrats for the first time ever. Then the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum, or APEC, ended in Papua New Guinea this weekend, and for the first time, no end-of-summit communique was issued. The U.S. and China exchanged repeated barbs over trade, and in the end, Papuan Prime Minister Peter O'Neill said, quote, "You all know who the two big giants in the room were, so what can I say?" Unquote. And then, at its first meeting since the midterm elections, the House Progressive Caucus, which has increased its membership by 20 thanks to those elections, announced its policy priorities. They include healthcare, jobs, and fighting corruption. And although the caucus chairman said that abolishing Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, was still on the table, it was pushed to secondary importance. And finally, today, we continue our segment, Education for Liberation, with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to the California wildfires. Those fires continued to burn out of control over the weekend, with 77 people now confirmed dead and at least 997 people still missing. President Trump visited Paradise, California, the town that was completely wiped out, and he called it Pleasure, California. He had to be corrected. He also claimed that the president of Finland told him that raking the forest floor would prevent future fires. That's something that the president of Finland has denied. We're joined from Burlington, Vermont by Fred Magdoff. He's a professor emeritus of plant and soil science at the University of Vermont and the co-author of What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism and Creating an Ecological Society Toward a Revolutionary Transformation, which is available from Monthly Review Press. Welcome back, Fred.
Good to be with you.
Boy, where do we start? I guess we can make fun of Donald Trump in a minute, but scientists have warned us for decades now that this is exactly what we would see because of climate change. We're going to see more intense weather patterns, more intense storms, drier climates in places like Northern California, bigger forest fires. Is that what this is? Is this just going to continue getting worse?
I expect it will. I think, someone said this is the new normal, and someone else said, no, it's not the new normal. It's going to be worse than this. It's just going to keep progressing. And I think the hot, dry summer, which, you know, it was exceptionally hot and dry, certainly is part of the story. There's no doubt about it. But, you know, this is only one part of the story, because there are other issues involved. I mean, building where they shouldn't be building and not having any, like, fire breaks. I mean, if you're going to have a town with so many people in a very potentially, you know, flammable area where there might be forest fires, there are things that can be done even in a situation like that that have not been done. So there are things that can be done to mitigate the potential of a disastrous fire like this. But they are going to happen, and they're going to happen more frequently.
Fred Magdoff is our guest. Donald Trump he was asked about, does this change his opinion on climate, meaning he's a denier of climate change or denies that it's human activity that's causing it. And he said, no, I want a great climate, or something like that. Anyway, just remarkable. Let's listen to an audio clip from Donald Trump.
There's been a lot of study going on over the last little while, and I will say, I think you're going to have, hopefully this is going to be the last of these, because this was a really, really bad one. And I know Gavin's committed, we're all committed, I'm committed to make sure that we get all of this cleaned out and protected. We've got to take care of the floors, you know, the floors of the forests, very important. You look at other countries where they do it differently, and it's a whole different story. I was with the president of Finland, and he said, we have a much different, we're a forest nation. He called it a forest nation. And they spend a lot of time on raking and cleaning and doing things, and they don't have any problem. And when it is, it's a very small problem. So I know everybody's looking at that to that end, and it's going to work out. It's going to work out well.
So, Fred, it's not climate change. It's raking.
Yeah, I can you just imagine the labor involved? First off, if it actually could work, is one thing. But even if it could, which I don't think it can, the incredible labor involved in raking these huge, you know, we're talking about millions of acres of forest. I mean, the whole thing is so absurd. I mean, there are things that can be done. You know, prescribed burns where every so often, maybe every 10 years or so, you go in. I'm talking about forest now as opposed to brush fires, grass fires, which really are much more difficult to deal with in a sense because the grass is going to grow every year and it's going to dry out in California every summer and it's going to be ready, you know, to burn every fall. But with forest, one thing that can be done is prescribed burns where you know, net forests naturally burn. That happens. And so if you go in and burn them every 10 years or 15 years, you know, a certain area, not huge, and you arrange it so that you're only, you know, affecting a certain portion of the fire, of the forest at any one time, then you have the potential of getting rid of a lot of, you know, the tinder that might, you know, keep a fire going or help spread a fire. So there are things that can be done with forest management, but it's also an issue of climate change, as we talked about, and it's also an issue of where people build and how they build, what building materials they use, and the surrounding areas. Can you know, there are ways to create large fire breaks around a community, and so there are things that people can do to mitigate the problem, but the problem is going to be there. And so it's a question of either you don't build in these areas or you build appropriately and are very, very careful about the surrounding portion, the perimeter, if you will, of a built-up area, and also the materials that are used and the methods used for construction.
Fred Magdoff is our guest. We're talking about the California wildfires. I want to talk a little bit more about the overbuilding and clearly the decision by real estate developers to build even where it's not safe. That seems in this case to be perhaps, in addition to climate change, the drought, the fact that there are, you know, it's too dry, unlike Finland, where it's cold and rainy a lot. California has had a long-term drought, and there doesn't seem to be any let-up in that. But let's talk a little bit more about what's actually happened. In many ways, this is the consequence of a kind of an urbanization of forest areas.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's attractive for people to live in, you know, in a community in a forest or sometimes individuals, you know, houses or cabins. But real estate interests really push developments in areas that they shouldn't. It's very similar to the real estate interest to pushing development in lowland areas along the coast and along rivers where there's going to be flooding. I mean, it's a very similar issue. These are places that you really shouldn't be building in. Or if you're going to build, you build in a certain way and you stay out of certain places, although you're sort of building in the neighborhood, but not right next to, you know, the floodplain. Obviously not in the floodplain. So I see the forest fire, the building issue with regard to forest and forest fires as very similar to the building issue with regard to flooding. And that is you have real estate interests which really drive these developments, and they will push it to the maximum. They will push development to wherever they can possibly develop. And if they're allowed to do it, people are going to be hurt.
Let's hear another audio clip from Donald Trump.
As big as they look on the tube, you don't see what's going on until you come here. And what we saw at Pleasure, what a name right now. But what we just saw, we just left Pleasure.
Paradise.
For Paradise. And what we just saw at Paradise is just, it's just not acceptable.
It's weird, Fred, that the President of the United States doesn't know exactly where he is, the name of the place. He's saying he talked to the Finnish president who told him if only the United States raked the floor of forests that we wouldn't have this kind of problem. The Finnish president, by the way, said he doesn't remember any conversation like that whatsoever. You have the president of the United States saying, no, climate change isn't, and he hasn't changed his opinion on it at all. If this is a big factor of life as it goes forward, this country and all countries, the world needs real leadership. It seems to me that while Donald Trump is easy to make fun of, he's not alone in this, in the sense that we don't have an adequate leadership or a leadership up to the challenge of doing what must be done, which is, as you said, there must be a transformation. Anyway, a minute left. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think on the world basis, there are here and there there are governments and local or national that are trying to do something anyway, trying to do something to ameliorate the problem of climate change, to slow it down. But yes, we need a massive program on a global basis, especially in the countries that are industrialized or the industrializing ones, like India, China, I guess, is industrialized and industrializing. To combat this, we have to stop using, fossil fuels, and we have to start by reducing our use of fossil fuels immediately. And I don't see any evidence that that's going to happen or that there's a will. The political reality is that the fossil fuel companies, have a lot of power.
That's the voice of Fred Magdoff. He's Professor Emeritus of Plant and Soil Science at the University of Vermont and the co-author of What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism and Creating an Ecological Society Toward a Revolutionary Transformation. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Democrats in the Georgia and Florida governor's races and the Florida Senate race conceded to the Republican challengers over the weekend amid charges of voter suppression. Meanwhile, all seven of Orange County, California's House races went to Democrats for the first time ever. We're joined from New York by Ted Rall, an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. And you can check out his work at Rall.com. Welcome back, Ted.
Thanks.
Ted, these charges of voter suppression were based on fact. I mean, the Democrats were able to point to instances and evidence of voter suppression. So first, I want to ask you about the state of politics in Georgia and Florida. It seems that Democrats ought to have won those races and didn't. Is it voter suppression that made the Democrats lose those races?
Well, you could argue that there's always a perfect storm in these things. It's kind of like Florida 2000 is the ultimate example of an election that ought to have gone Democratic and didn't. And I mean, by some recount estimates, Al Gore actually won the state of Florida by thousands or maybe even tens of thousands of votes. But the newspaper recounts, not the official recounts. And of course, the counterpoint to that is, why was it so close that it would even be an issue? Voter suppression comes into play in these very close races. So I think what we're sort of seeing is a combination of the fact that Florida is a classic swing state. Georgia has become a swing state. And voter suppression, as usually, comes out of the state secretary of state's office, which supervises state elections, something that most Americans aren't really that aware of, that it just comes out of this kind of obscure office that people don't even know what they do. The secretary of state sounds like a diplomatic post. It's like, why would a state need one? But it's kind of obscure. And, it's like redistricting and gerrymandering and all that. And things that Greg Palaston has pointed out about caging and all these other tactics that are used to keep down Democratic votes in particular. But I think obviously suppression took place. Just a detailed statistical analysis still remains to be done that will be able to say with some degree of certainty whether these races were absolutely tilted. But certainly in Georgia, the losing candidate seemed pretty certain that it made the difference, or at least that's what she's alleging.
And it was the Secretary of State who was running for Georgia as a Republican in
Kemp.
Yeah, Kemp. He was running for governor in Georgia. How much more unethical could that possibly be, where you're the one in charge of voter rolls, maintaining voter rolls, for example? You're running for governor, and what you do is you throw off hundreds of thousands of people off the rolls. Although, Ted, I want to ask you a question that I heard on NPR today, and I thought it was interesting. Even in the District of Columbia, if you haven't voted in the last 4 years, you're removed from the voter rolls. So what makes what Kemp did in Georgia different from what a place like Washington, D.C. does as a matter of course? What makes it voter suppression, I guess, is the question.
Well, I would argue that what they do in D.C. is voter suppression, too. I mean, it's not part of the social or contract or our legal system or our Constitution that we have a use it or lose it voter system. What happens is that people might, who knows, maybe you were kidnapped by ISIS for 4 years and you come back and you don't know. Nobody knows about these laws. They're not widely publicized.
I know the ISIS kidnapping scenario is frequent, but there's another one that may be even more frequent, which is you get to the polls in Washington. It's 7:30. Yeah. There's a very long line. It's raining. You decide, oh, the election's kind of a given anyway. The Democrats are going to win everything. I'm just going to go home.
Yep.
So then 4 years later, you lose your right to vote.
And 4 years is not a long time. I mean, a lot of people don't vote most people do not vote in midterm elections or off-year elections.
Correct.
They just don't. They don't vote for mayor. They don't. So most people just vote every 4 years.
Stacey Abrams, who lost the governorship in Georgia, told CNN on Jake Tapper's State of the Union that she thought that there had been deliberate interference in the election. She conceded that Brian Kemp was the winner, the Secretary of State in Georgia, her opponent, that he did win, but she says it's not a legitimate victory. She said, quote, "It began 8 years ago with the systematic disenfranchisement of more than a million voters. It continued with the underfunding and disinvestment in polling places, in training, and in the management of the county delivery of services. And I think it had its pinnacle in this race. So, yes, there was deliberate and intentional disinvestment and, I think, destruction of the administration of elections in the state of Georgia." So that's Stacey Abrams' so-called concession, which is not a concession, just saying, yeah, I lost, but under these circumstances.
Well, it's I lost and I was cheated. I was robbed. And, she's probably not wrong. There's so many, you could literally write a book, and Greg Palast has, about voter suppression and all the tactics that go. I mean, one thing that happened in Georgia is very reminiscent of 2004 in Ohio, where I grew up. My mother still lives in Dayton. She's white, lives in a white neighborhood. She had no weight whatsoever to vote, but the Republican Secretary of State pulled voting booths out of downtown Dayton, which is predominantly African American. And her black friends waited many, many hours.
That's what happened in Georgia.
Yeah.
Up to 10 hours.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened in Georgia, to the point where some polling locations had to ask for permission to stay open later just because there were so many people in line who hadn't had the opportunity to vote because they were all forced into this one polling location.
And then you have kids at home. They're back
that's
from
right.
school. If you thought it would take an hour, now you're there 3 hours. You have to make a decision. I got kids. They have to go to school tomorrow. They have to eat dinner. I have to leave. So even when the polls stay open, a number of people, and we don't know the exact number, but we know for sure a certain number of people are not going to be able to stay with it.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
They have to leave. And the thing is, we have to remember here, it can't possibly be an innocent mistake. This is not a new democracy like South Sudan or something. Okay, they know these populations have been there year after year after year. They know how many people voted in each precinct the previous year, 2 years ago, 4 years ago. They know roughly how many machines they need. They really do know.
Sure they do. Ted, I want to switch over to California and talk about Orange County, California. Orange County historically has been the wealthy Republican bastion of Southern California. Orange County has been represented in Congress by Republicans since California became a state, practically, since the founding of the Republican Party in 1856. And this year, for the very first time ever, all 7 members of Congress from Orange County are going to be Democrats. Some very important Republicans were unseated. People like Dana Rohrabacher and Daryl Issa, who was the chairman of the Governmental Affairs Committee, he gave up his seat and a Democrat won it. What do you make of this over the long term? Is this a real shift? Is this a political watershed? Or is this a fluke because Californians hate Donald Trump?
It's not a fluke. It's part of what two pollster demographers predicted in their book called The Emerging Democratic Majority that was published about 25 years ago, that stated that demographic shifts, particularly in the southwestern United States, were going to lead to more reliable Democratic majorities in places that we now consider, or that we then considered, Republican. I mean, for example, Arizona was the most Republican of Republican states, the home of Barry Goldwater and John McCain.
Wouldn't recognize Martin Luther King's birthday as a holiday even after it became a national law.
Exactly. I mean, they couldn't even get behind daylight savings time. They were so retrograde. And yeah, now Arizona, I think you can credibly call a purple state. And I think Orange County, you know, has been moving steadily in that direction for years. So I don't think this is just a reaction to Trump. I think this is the changing demographics. It's a increasingly Latino and not like Cuban Latino, which tends to be conservative in South Florida. But, you know, Mexican Latino, Central American Latino, which to the second generation voters tend to lean more Democratic. So I think this is the way. The present is the future, I think.
I think you're right. We have less than 1 minute left, and I want to ask you really quickly about the Mississippi Senate race. We've got a Democrat, Mike Espy, running against an incumbent senator who made a joke just the other day about being willing to witness a public hanging. Pundits are saying that there's a real chance the Democrats can win the Senate seat, just like they did in Alabama, if black women turn out. Yes or no? Do you think this is a winnable seat for the Democrats?
I got to say, this one would blow me away. There's a big difference between a tasteless joke about capital punishment and being a child molester,
yeah.
Which Roy Moore was. You know, I mean, even is, you know, Roy Moore came damn close in Alabama. Let's not forget that.
Yes.
He should have gotten like 2 votes, him and his mom or something. So it's just really, I don't think so. But hey, you know, it would be a pleasant surprise if I were wrong.
That was the voice of Ted Rall, who is correct about the Mississippi Senate race. Ted is in New York right now. He's an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist, and you can check out his work at Rall, RALL.com. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum, or APEC, ended in Papua New Guinea this weekend, and for the first time, no end-of-summit communique was issued. The U.S. and China exchanged repeated barbs over trade, and in the end, Papua New Guinea Prime Minister Peter O'Neill said, quote, "You all know who the two big giants in the room were, so what can I say?" Unquote. We're joined from London by Jude Woodward. She's the author of the book, The U.S. and China, Asia's New Cold War. Welcome back, Jude.
Thanks. Nice to speak to you.
Jude, this is the first time that no communique was issued at the end, and by all accounts, this summit was a failure. What do you make of it?
Well, it's going to be increasingly past the course, I think, as the U.S. has made it clear it's going to intervene more and more strongly against China in the Asia-Pacific region. This has happened before, not at APEC, but back under Obama when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. An ASEAN summit ended without a final statement because Hillary Clinton tried to insist that there should be a big attack on China in the closing statement for its actions in the South China Sea on that occasion. On this occasion, the U.S. wanted it to include strong language against alleged unfair trade practices that it accuses China of. And this was, attacking China is not what the countries of the region want to do. That's not to say that they all have no criticisms of China. That's all aligned with China. Many are more aligned with the United States. But the region is very dependent on trade with China, and they want an integrated and peaceful region for development. And so attacking China in the closing statement is not what most of those countries want. So it's a, sort of presented as the US versus China, and both were problematic. But really and truly, it was the US trying to get an attack on China into the statement that caused the problem.
Jude Woodward is our guest. I want to read, John, from Mike Pence's speech that he delivered at the Hudson Institute. This was a month, six weeks before.
Yes, he laid out the policy in advance.
On the 4th of October.
October 4th. I want to read a couple sentences for our audience, because this, I think, pretty much captures where the U.S. is going and what the bottom line thesis is. So that at this conference or at other conferences over this dispute or that dispute, each one will have its own interesting twist and turn, but we have to understand the fundamentals, the essence of the evolved and now articulated American policy. Here it is. After the fall of the Soviet Union, we assumed that a free China was inevitable. Heady with optimism at the turn of the 21st century, America agreed to give Beijing open access to our economy, and we brought China into the World Trade Organization. Previous administrations made this choice in the hope that freedom in China would expand in all of its forms, not just economically, but politically, with a newfound respect for classical liberal principles, private property, personal liberty, religious freedom, the entire family of human rights. But that hope has gone unfulfilled. The dream of freedom remains distant for the Chinese people. And while Beijing still pays lip service to, quote, reform and opening, close quote, Deng Xiaoping's famous policy now rings hollow. This means that the United States, when it integrated or allowed the integration of China into the world economy and part of the WTO, there was an assumption that it was inevitable that they would achieve freedom. By freedom, Mike Pence means that the end of the rule of the Communist Party of China and the ending of that government, as happened in the Soviet Union. That's why it seemed inevitable.
Right.
But it has not happened. And in fact, the Chinese government and the Chinese Communist Party are still strong. They're still there. And China has grown economically to compete with the United States, or to, as Pence said at the APEC, also at this speech at the Hudson Institute, to do away with a system whereby the United States enjoyed advantages, also known as the world order. And that's, it seems to me, Jude, to be the foundation. The U.S. expected the Chinese government to fall. It did not fall. And now they're going back to sort of revamping U.S. strategy towards China with this now realistic assumption that the Chinese government won't fall simply because it's been integrated into the world capitalist economy. What do you think?
Yeah, well, one has not really been integrated into the world capitalist economy in a simple sense, because the role of the state in China is vastly greater than it is in any straightforwardly capitalist economy, of course. And that's really what the US object to, because strangely enough, although the neoliberal theory is that this excessive, as they would say, state intervention should mean that the economy fails because it's not allowing the rule of the market to properly work things out.
But Jude, let me just jump in here. But you would agree that China has, as a result of U.S. policy and its integration into the WTO, China is integrated into the world economy.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what China sought to do. That was one part of Deng Xiaoping's reform and opening up. The opening up was precisely the understanding that the economy, even in a socialist country or a country in transition to socialism, whatever we want to call it, couldn't function outside the world market. There was no autarkic socialism in one country solution. You had to participate in the international division of labor. And that was certainly part of Deng Xiaoping's understanding of what he was doing with reform and opening up. But to return to the question about the US, from 1989 onwards, the U.S. have essentially hung their hopes on the fact that there would be a Chinese Gorbachev, that each time, and you can see this if you read the press, each time a new president has come in China, the Western press has engaged in huge speculation, have we at last got our Gorbachev? In other words, a leader of China who would politically capitulate to the demands of the West, which is what happened to the Soviet Union. Gorbachev capitulated to the demands of the West, and then they smashed up the Soviet Union itself, and then smashed up the Soviet, Russian economy. This hasn't worked. There has been no Chinese Gorbachev, and there looks like there isn't going to be one. So they're having to pursue a different tactic. I don't think they've ever changed their view that this is what they want to achieve, but they've now decided there's not going to be a Chinese Gorbachev who just hands it over to the West, and they have to try and smash it up economically from the outside first in order to achieve the political goal of subordinating China to the West.
Jude, a friend of mine who's a China expert called me this morning, and we were talking about this summit, and he told me that he actually fears that this trade war between the U.S. and China can spin out of control and become a military confrontation. Do you see that happening? Is there such a scenario?
Well, I certainly think that the military aspect of the situation is serious. The announcement alongside the APEC summit that the U.S. would participate with Australia in building a new base in Papua New Guinea means a strengthening of the Americans' position in the Pacific. There is a lot of speculation that the reason Trump took the U.S. out of the INF treaty is because the Pentagon wants to station intermediate-range nuclear weapons in Guam, possibly in Japan, in some scenarios in South Korea, in order to counter Chinese defenses. So there's clearly a strong pressure towards military confrontation coming from the United States. There are a lot of reasons why that would be disastrous, and not just for China, but for the United States itself, because this would not be something that was confined to a Pacific theater. It would, China has the capacity to send missiles to America if that was what was, if an all-out war was involved. So there are a lot of reasons why that won't happen, but certainly military threats is part of the situation.
Ben Hodges, who was the Supreme Commander of European Forces until 2017, was speaking in Warsaw back in October, the same time Mike Pence made his speech. And he was making the argument that the European alliance was very, very important to the U.S. because it was one pillar of a global military strategy. And Hodges said, he believed that it was likely that the United States would be at war with China in 15 years. Now, that's not Brian Becker saying that. That's not Jude Woodward. This is Ben Hodges, the Supreme Commander of American Forces in Europe. It does, you know, give you a window at least into how they're thinking and how they're talking, Jude.
Well, that's undoubtedly the case. And I mean, it frightened me when I read that. I thought, blimey, we're heading for World War III, because that's what it would be. It wouldn't be a confined, you know, Middle East war or a confined war somewhere. It would be a world war. And obviously, the National Defense Strategy, which was published in January, was completely clear that the key aim of the Pentagon strategizing is to be able to win a war with China. And it said that the procurement, the actual plans for military procurement, which are classified, and we don't know exactly what they are, were worked out by building scenarios for winning a war with China. So this is undoubtedly part of their thinking. At the moment, they haven't got a strategy to win a war with China, so we'll have to wait and see how that goes.
I think it's important, John, we're running out of time, but I think it's important that we discuss this, actually, because, frankly, U.S. military policymakers, when they think back to World War II, they're not thinking, hey, 86 million human beings died, or maybe it was 90 or 95 million humans died in 4 or 5 years. They're thinking, we won that war. We became the dominant force politically in the world. Yeah, 400,000 Americans died. A million plus were wounded. But American cities were left intact. American factories were left intact. The U.S. basically changed the global politics such that the U.S. became the dominant power. So it's important for our audience not to think of world wars simply from the point of view of human carnage and disaster and catastrophe and suffering, but to also think how policymakers and war makers might actually view it, because then it suddenly seems that the unthinkable becomes thinkable.
We're out of time, so we'll have to leave it there. We were joined from London by Jude Woodward. Jude's the author of the book, The U.S. and China, Asia's New Cold War. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
At its first meeting since the midterm elections, the House Progressive Caucus, which has increased its membership by 20 thanks to those elections, announced its policy priorities. They include healthcare, jobs, and fighting corruption. And although the caucus chairman said that abolishing Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, was still on the table, it was pushed to secondary importance. We're joined from Los Angeles by Juan Jose Gutierrez, the executive director of the Full Rights for Immigrants Coalition. Welcome back, Juan Jose.
Thank you, John.
I'm just wondering, Juan Jose and John, does this mean, as I think it does mean, that the chant abolish ICE, which came from the grassroots in response to the terrible raids by Immigration and Customs Enforcement and echoed by the Democrats during the midterm election campaign, was it for the Democrats just an ephemeral, temporary, and opportunist joining in with the grassroots? And now that they've got a House controlled by the Democrats, that it was like, oh, well, we didn't really mean it.
My take on it, Brian, is exactly what you said at the end of your introductory statement. The fact that the Congressional Progressive Caucus has a press conference, and when pressed on the issue of whether or not they're going to insist on the abolition of ICE and how they decided to deal with that question, seems to indicate, to me at least, that the abolish ICE slogan was nothing more than ephemeral, temporary, and very opportunistic, because it came from the grassroots and the Democratic Party was desperate to take back the House, to materialize this so-called blue wave. That has happened, and so now we're going back to business as usual, even though they couch going back to business as usual in typical Democratic Party parlance, where they basically say, you know, immigration, comprehensive immigration reform is still on the agenda. It is a high priority. We will insist on it. But, you know, we have to deal with the business that are really, really important, as was said on the introduction, healthcare, good paying jobs, and doing away with the culture of corruption. So this does not bode well for the struggle of immigrant rights in this country.
Juan Jose, there's a congresswoman from Washington State by the name of Pramila Jayapal, and she proposed legislation over the summer. It would not abolish ICE, even though that was a slogan. It would actually enact immigration reform. And when she was confronted at this press conference earlier this week as part of the House Progressive Caucus, and a reporter asked her about this legislation, that she campaigned on a policy of abolishing ICE. She introduced legislation, but it does not abolish ICE. It reforms immigration, but it leaves ICE intact. They asked her how she could reconcile the two. She became angry, and she said that, well, you just didn't read my bill. You don't understand this issue because you didn't read the bill. So I ask you, Juan Jose, should ICE be abolished? And if so, what would take its place?
Well, let's backtrack a little bit, John. This congresswoman from Washington, Pramila Jayapal, did introduce legislation over the summer to terminate ICE. Now, the last time I checked the meaning of terminate, it really is the same thing as abolish, as do away with, get rid of. So whether she used the exact word abolish or not, as far as I'm concerned, it's more of this traditional tactic that politicians use to weasel their way out of what appears to be at first firm political commitments with regards to specific constituencies. In this case, the immigrant community. Now, To be fair, Congresswoman Parmila Jayapal did introduce legislation to reform our immigration system. But the fact remains that along with that bill that she introduced, it did contain language that could be interpreted as a call to abolish ICE. Now, I think we should be thankful to Parmila that she now goes on record at this press conference on Monday, where she says, look, just because we made a call to terminate ICE, which doesn't mean abolish ICE, it doesn't mean that we want to end the functions of ICE, meaning, you know, that arrests, incarceration, and ultimate deportation and the tearing of families, of immigrant families, will continue. So again, you know, this demagoguery that people across the country are getting sick and tired of by our politicians, including so-called progressive politicians, is real. I mean, we deeply resent the progressive politicians say one thing, and then once elections are over, they, you know, they go around and they continue to do the same things, you know, that all type politicians, you know, have been doing. And I think that's, you know, the really critical point in this conversation. You know, at this press conference, we had individuals like, for example, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez from New York, who has been dubbed, you know, the socialist candidate, who's now Congresswoman elect. She didn't say anything about whether, you know, what she thought about whether or not ICE should be abolished. So, you know, it's cause for great concern that this new generation of Democrats, progressive Democrats, you know, cannot, you know, muster the courage to have the political spine to stand by principle, political principles, you know, which they advocate for, and they should be, you know, defending all the way through.
It's funny that you say that because I thought exactly the same thing. She was at that caucus meeting, and she said almost nothing about abolishing ICE. She sounded very moderate in her statement. And, you know, that's not how she sounded on the campaign trail when she defeated a 10-term incumbent in Joe Crowley. And I wondered if there was pullback. And then I wondered further if the caucus was told to pull back.
Well, it's likely the latter rather than the former. In other words, you know, I think, you know, we all heard it in the past. Those of us that are old enough to, you know, to know politics in the way that we do, you know, in the Democratic Party or even in the Republican Party, in the traditional parties, candidates go and they make these very strong calls on behalf of this or that policy. But once they get elected into office, all of a sudden we're told the reality sets in and that we have to understand, you know, the cold facts of politics where you have to be pragmatic and deal with the reality that you can only do so much, and the change comes about very, very slowly, and that it's a mistake to try and bring about change in one big scoop. So, you know, it's cause for concern and great disappointment, I would say.
This is all really window dressing, of course, so long as the Republicans control the Senate and a Republican is in the White House. But it's important in that it will help to lay the groundwork for whatever the Democratic policy program is going to be. Eventually, Democrats are going to win the Senate and the White House again. It's cyclical. This is how politics are.
And let's think back. They had the House and the Senate and a popular president in 2009, 2010.
Yep.
They could have done whatever they wanted to do, including passing comprehensive immigration reform, and they did not do it.
That's right.
They will. Democrats will not. Anybody who argues we must work, if you're a progressive inside the Democratic Party for real change, there was never a more favorable arrangement than what existed in 2009, 2010. They had big majority in the House, big majority in the Senate, popular president. They didn't do it.
That's right. And in fact, now, well, you and I were talking offline. Now Democrats are all starting to sound like John McCain on immigration.
Yeah. When John McCain becomes the liberal and like sounding like the progressive caucus, you know, the country has gone to the right. Go ahead.
Yeah. You know, what's tragic about this whole thing is that judging by what Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal said in her statement about whether or not I should be abolished, you know, I couldn't avoid thinking that, you know, to her, it's all a question of semantics, right? I mean, she thinks that the ICE brand is damaged goods and that it'd be much more practical and better for the, you know, to advance the interests of the Democratic Party to eventually, as you said, recoup control of both houses of Congress and eventually the presidency, you know, to bury ICE and revive, in a matter of speaking, a better sounding name to do the dirty work of immigration department, right? You know, so for example, bury ICE and bring back the Immigration and Naturalization Service, which was done away with. That's a better sounding name because, you know, it offers immigration and services, you know, the way it ought to be. So, you know, I mean, this is all confusing to the people that have been clamoring for change in our immigration policy and in the behavior of the agencies charged with the responsibility of applying immigration law in this country. So, you know, cause for great concern.
You are right. We will leave it there. We were joined from Los Angeles by Juan José Gutiérrez, the executive director of the Full Rights for Immigrants Coalition. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our segment, Education for Liberation, with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? Bill joins us from Chicago. He is an activist, educator, and the co-author of the new book, You Can't Fire the Bad Ones, and 18 other myths about teachers, teachers' unions, and public education. You can check out his work at www.billayers.org. Welcome back, Bill.
It's nice to hear your voice.
Sorry that you have laryngitis, but it's nice to hear your voice, too.
Thank you. I've been fighting a cold, and it's part of the time of year.
It is indeed. Hey, I wanted to begin with an opinion piece from the New York Times that I think was absolutely fascinating. It was entitled, Why I Dread Returning to an American Public School. And it's about a woman who is from California. She and her family moved to Munich for 6 years, and now they're returning to California. And she's comparing California public schools with German public schools. Tell us about that.
Well, what I found fascinating about it was that we Americans, because of the constant propaganda about being the best place in the world, often overlook what really is going on around healthcare, around transportation, around housing, but from my point of view, most importantly, around schools. This opinion piece is fantastic. She not only describes well-resourced schools, but she describes a full arts program that her children are, you know, are privy to. And after school doesn't just include chess and theater, but it includes, for example, circus. And that's what her daughter takes. This is the kind of offering that these kids get as a natural part of being part of the Munich public schools. The other thing that I thought was fascinating was she says at one point, I'm really astonished to walk. It took a while to get used to, but she would walk her child to the bus stop, get on public transportation with a bunch of other little kids, and they would take public transportation to their school. It was not considered dangerous. It was not considered unusual. That struck me as very, very telling about the kind of social network we have here for children and what exists elsewhere in the world.
The name of the article is Why I Dread Returning to an American Public School. Look it up, everyone. It was published November 10th, 2018. Our daughter's elementary school, which she graduated from a few years ago, offered a rich curriculum from math and sciences to arts and languages. After school, in addition to the more traditional offerings of chess, theater, and computers, she could take, as Bill points out, circus lessons where children learn to juggle, walk on a tightrope, and ride a unicycle. Since her school did not have a pool, students were bused every week to a nearby sports club for swim lessons, again, at no extra charge. Yeah, this could be the life, at least in advanced capitalist or advanced industrial societies, with priority on public schools. this kind of offering could be available to all children.
Absolutely. There's another aspect, which it made me think about the fact that Ithaca, New York, just declared itself America's first, quote, free-range kids city. By that, they mean that kids should be allowed to play. And they've created the conditions where instead of parents being ridiculed or shamed or even arrested for allowing their children to walk home from school, for example, or to play in the park unsupervised, they encourage this in Ithaca, and they encourage the whole town to take responsibility for creating a social scene in which that's possible. I thought that was also fantastic.
You know, there was another aspect of this too, and that was one of the field trips was to Austria, where each kid has to go for a walk at night through a field because it fosters independence.
Isn't that wild?
And a great idea.
It's almost unthinkable in our society.
I can't even imagine it.
Yeah, it's right. But it's true.
I want to turn back to the Ithaca story that Bill just mentioned.
Yeah.
Ithaca is a city in the Finger Lakes. It's the San Francisco of the Finger Lakes. Cornell University is there. A small city, but a progressive city. Here's the article from the Ithaca Voice that Bill was alluding to. City proclaims Ithaca's kids are free to play. We believe in the power of play, the mayor said, given the choice between living here where your kids can run outside and find a bunch of friends to play with, and another city where just allowing your kids to walk home from the park could get you arrested. We know that families will joyfully choose Ithaca. Well, you know, Bill Ayers and John Kiriakou, I mean, we're old enough that this was, in fact, the way things were.
Oh, yeah.
At least the way things were when I grew up as a kid. I saw my parents for a little while in the morning, and then maybe at the very, very end of the day, nobody was monitoring us.
And in fact, every house in the neighborhood owned a bell, and each bell had a different tone to it. And so your mom would ring the bell when it was time to come home for dinner, and you recognized the sound of your bell. Otherwise, we were never inside the house.
We didn't have any bells, but... But that's interesting. Bill Ayers, again, this is a generational thing, but it's become systemic.
I think it's partly the nature of the kind of competitive, hierarchical, fear-based society that we've created. And I don't really hark back to a glorious day, but I do think that we've become so isolated that we don't see the value of a social network, the value of a community. Instead, we have an individual on their own, each family. When we talk about family values, we're never talking about other people's families. We're always saying, I'll take care of my own. The rest of y'all can go jump off a bridge. And that's really a dangerous development that I think is hardening in our society.
Bill Ayers is our guest. We talk to Bill every Monday in this segment called Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers. Bill Ayers is an activist and award-winning educator, the author of numerous books, including You Can't Fire the Bad Ones, and 18 Other Myths About Teachers, Teachers Unions, and Public Education. Bill is also the author of A Radical Manifesto, Demand the Impossible. Bill, I want to talk about education policy at the federal level. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos proposes controversial changes to campus sexual misconduct rules. This is, well, it's a bizarre story. It's also a dangerous development. Go ahead.
Well, I think it is, but I also think that it's an indicator of what the Trump administration stands for. They're not interested in the victims of sexual harassment and sexual violence. They're interested in the perpetrators. And what we have here is a turning back the clock. I don't think they're going to get away with it in the sense that the moment of the Me Too movement is too strong. What we witnessed in the midterms is too strong to allow this to stand. But I do think it's a good indicator of where the Trump administration is going. Speaking of the midterms, I think we saw some very positive developments if people take the lessons from it and begin to organize. For example, in Arizona, the voters defeated overwhelmingly a bill to expand the state's private school voucher program. In New York, they really turned back the kind of love affair with charter schools. And I think this is all part of the same story. That is, if we organize for education as a human right, if we organize for the reality that every child deserves a full, comprehensive, decent education, I think we're on the right track. I think we can win.
Bill, we have 2 minutes left, and I want to go quickly to a story about Amazon. Amazon announced this past week that its HQ2, its second headquarters, is going to be split between Arlington, Virginia, Crystal City neighborhood of Arlington, Virginia, and Queens, New York. This is going to cost a lot of money for both states. New York agreed to give Amazon $1 billion worth of tax breaks, $500 million from the state of Virginia. This is money that otherwise could have been spent on education. How do you see this this playing out?
Well, I think the rationale always from the political class and from the corporate class is that we won't come to you unless you give us breaks and you give us a beautiful kind of rose-lined highway into development. And what we're promising you is jobs. Take a close look at these things as they develop, and you'll see that it's just part of a great shell game. That is to say, they don't create the jobs they said they would create, and to the extent that they create new jobs, they drive out other jobs. The reality is, if you want to attract corporations to a city, one way to do it is to have a safe environment, good schools, decent housing, good transportation, but they never go down that line. Instead, they give Amazon $1.5 billion, a corporation that is so rich, a CEO who has trillions. This is obscene, and anyone in New York should be rising up against this. Anyone in D.C. should be rising up. It's, you know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of the shell game of attracting the Olympics, like somehow the Olympics are going to bring great economic development. They never do. They bring a kind of gentrification, a kind of militarization of the police, and they leave behind them a shell. It's not worth anything.
And the idea, John Kiriakou, that somehow New York City has to lure companies. I mean, New York has
right.
everything to offer, including, you know, huge numbers of people who are trained high-tech workers. The idea that you have to give $1 billion to a company like Amazon, ludicrous on all fronts.
Indeed it is. We were very pleased to be joined by Bill Ayers. Bill was in Chicago. He's an activist, educator, and the co-author of the new book, You Can't Fire the Bad Ones, and 18 Other Myths About Teachers, Teachers Unions, and Public Education. I read this book, and it's fantastic. You can check out his work at www.billayers.org. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can hear us here at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.